This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello and welcome to Trumpet Hour this Friday, June 14th. I'm Philip Nice with our Philadelphia trumpet writers, Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
Mihailo Zekic.
Good to be here.
Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
Every week we bring you the four regions of the world and the news of the week and its relation to Bible prophecy. The first region this week has been very active in the news. It's the Europe region. Mr. Palmer, will you give us an update on Europe?
Germany put forward a fascinating halfway house towards conscription this week. They're definitely moving in the direction of conscripting people into the army. They used to do that until 2011. And now with Russia being more aggressive, they're looking at getting back into that. Instead, what they're going to do, though, is a halfway point, is they're going to send out a mandatory questionnaire to young men that will ask them about their ability and interest to serve in the military. Women can answer the questionnaire as well, but it's not compulsory. And then they'll look at the responses from the questionnaire, and then they'll kind of select those that they think are the best motivated, the best qualified, the most healthy, and they'll serve in the military for 6 months with an option to voluntarily extend that for an additional 17 months. So that would be, I guess, nearly 2 years, and then they'll have the option to become part of the military or the reserves from there on out. So it's a pretty big piece of news in terms of the German military stepping up. This is a way of getting them just more personnel, but also an indication of, you know, what they're thinking, and that they really do feel like we need more military capability and we need to come up with unique, innovative ways of making that happen. I'll also just touch on another piece of news just from the UK, with our election continuing to roll on with polling day in just about 3 weeks. We had a YouGov poll today that showed the Reform UK party overtaking the Conservative Party for the first time ever. The Reform, this is Nigel Farage's kind of new right-wing party. And I think just the way that first-past-the-post voting systems work, both in the, you know, we have the same in the UK as you have in the US, it is very hard for upstart parties to break through. I don't expect that to translate to Reform getting more seats in Parliament necessarily than the Conservatives. But imagine if you had a brand new right-wing party that was polling higher than the Republicans. That would be a pretty big deal. So I think it shows we're in for some interesting times in Britain's general election coming up on July 4th.
Well, the tumult and churning of elections and voting and so forth in Europe has been something that we've been eager to jump on, eager to look for throughout Trumpet Hour. But this week in particular, it's been dominating headlines far, far beyond Trumpet Hour. Take us into the European elections and what's been happening there.
So last weekend, you had European Parliament elections going from Thursday to the Sunday. And the big takeaway is that far right or fringe groups did very well, especially in the core of Europe, France and Germany. I think those two were by far the most dramatic. Given that the EU is not particularly unified, it was not the same trend country across country. You know, it's a different story if you look at the Nordics or if you look at the Iberian Peninsula. That wasn't necessarily the case. But France and Germany had these dramatic swings to upstart parties. We'll talk about France first. I think Germany's the more important. The France was the more dramatic this week. It used to be called the National Front. They've rebranded since then as National Rally. They came in first place. This is Marine Le Pen's party. They often get called far right in the press. Far left is probably just as an accurate description. They do also have some very socialist tight policies, but they're very much about France for the French, standing up to migration, standing up to Islam in particular, and all of that kind of thing. So they came in first. They won 31.5% of the vote. And Mr. Macron, the president's alliance, he got less than half of that. Yeah, massive, massive defeat for them. And so he is now apparently jealous of kind of Britain's level of instability, called a snap election right. as well. I mean, we're taking their spot. Well, this is their thing, holding quick elections and political turmoil. So they're now having an election. There's going to be a couple of rounds, but the first round for that election is the end of the month. So lightning fast election. First of all, I think he's kind of thinking, well, look, if I'm going to spend the rest of my time in office as a lame duck, where everyone knowing I have no popular support, let's bite the bullet and get this over with now. And I think he's also hoping, okay, you had your fun. You voted for the fringe party in the European elections, but I'm going to dare you to do the same thing in a real election that kind of has actual consequence instead of the European Parliament that is kind of a charade of an election to give Europe the appearance of democracy. So he's kind of saying, well, I bet you're not going to do that in a real election. Also, the mainstream left did really terribly too, and so he might be kind of angling to try and destroy that particular opponent for him. But whatever the reason, he's called that. Now we've had even more drama and turmoil in France from the right. So the leader of the mainstream right party came out and said, hey, we should do an alliance with National Rally in the run-up to the election. And that's a huge deal for France. Like, you go all the way back to the 90s when the National Front first started to do very well. And even any time there was any kind of appearance from the National Rally of having some progress, the mainstream left and right would come together and banish them. You know, the equivalent of the Republicans would vote for the Democratic candidate rather than let the National Front get a foothold. It's been that way for decades. And so for the leader of the mainstream right party to come out and say we should do an alliance with Marine Le Pen, that is massive. That is the ending of this very long-standing process that has really kind of been the gold standard for all of Europe on excluding fringe parties. So he came out and did that. His party then immediately kicked him out of office and said, no, you're no longer our leader. This is too radical for us. We're not doing this. He is claiming that he is not kicked out of office and started a lawsuit basically saying, no, the way that you kicked me out is unconstitutional. Now it's all before the courts. There's even the possibility that the courts might rule this is too much of a mess for us to sort out by the deadline of the election date. The election has to be postponed. Nobody's quite sure what's going to happen. It looks like this mainstream right-wing party may well split, and the right half of the mainstream party, kind of the equivalent of the Republicans, say, may well go off and join National Rally. So the whole thing is becoming this big political circus, but you very well could have National Rally being the dominant force and supplying the prime minister, and they wouldn't have the presidency. That's not up for grabs at this election. But they would basically dominate the equivalent of Congress and the Senate, and they'd have the prime minister, and they would control the French domestic agenda from here on out. So that's the French drama this week.
So the AFD doing well in Germany, the National Rally doing well in France. We have talked about how these parties have mainstreamed themselves a little bit, have moderated some of their more extreme positions or rhetoric. I've wondered and talked with you a little bit about this. Are we looking at the end of an era, or has there always been this kind of wild element to European politics? And when I first started paying attention to European politics, you know, in the 90s and so forth, the center was dominant. I don't know if you want to call it a uniparty, but there was kind of a predictability. And now that seems to be going out the window. Was the 90s an anomaly, or is what we're having now, as I say, the end of an era?
Basically, the 2008 financial crisis was a big smack for European politics. And since then, the cracks have been widening and deepening. I think that's what is happening. If you look at Germany, say, in particular, and we can put some numbers on it, and it's pretty stark. I mean, basically, pre-2008, just about every election, the mainstream right and the mainstream left, between them would get about 80% of the vote. That made German politics pretty stable and predictable. And one of those parties would usually be able to form a coalition on their own or need a small coalition partner. Since 2008, that has just been shrinking. So as soon as you get to 2009, they're about 50% of the vote. You kind of get to this election, I think it was around 45% if you add up the combined mainstream left, mainstream right. And now German politics is fractured to the point that you just basically have this whole different hodgepodge of small parties that have somewhere between 15 to 30% of the vote, and a coalition becomes this very difficult exercise to find three parties that can get together that can form a coalition. And it's generally like that all across Europe. There are anomalies. You know, I think it was Jean-Marie Le Pen that nearly beat Jacques Chirac in France back in the 90s. There have been upstart parties where somebody might quit and start their own party, and it does. But in terms of a European-wide movement, this is new. And it's something that is just, you had it in 2008, and nobody has found a solution to it. Because once you have this problem where it's hard for mainstream parties to form coalitions, it almost like it pushes the mainstream then towards the center, because the only option is to have a, say, Republican-Democrat coalition. So everyone pushes towards the center. That then makes more and more voters unhappy. They split off towards the extremes because they're like, well, what's the point of me even voting for a right-wing party if I get this vague centrist,
right,
probably even left-wing coalition, when you just factor in there's always this left-wing drift to society? Like, so they start splitting off, which then adds further incentive to have these centralist coalitions, and you get more split. And so nobody's found a way to really stop that. So that's why I've kind of called it a death spiral, because it just has politics kind of falling apart. That's what you're seeing across Europe. And I think the point we made last week is really you're seeing a change across culture now within Germany. It's not just a political phenomenon. So if we look at the German elections now, this is where you had the Alternative for Deutschland coming in second place with, I think, about 16, 17% of the vote, and this very ominous record milestone of the best performance by a far-right party in a nationwide election since World War II. And the governing coalition, the three parties combined that make up the coalition, those three parties combined got less than a third of the vote, or right around a third of the vote. So actually, there's a lot in Germany looking on at France and saying, that's what we need to do. We need fresh elections. Clearly, this government has lost its mandate if two-thirds of people voted for some other party. So they're kind of almost jealous of the French political turmoil, because at least something's going to change in France. But this rise of the AfD is really quite dramatic. And we have a landmark article, I think, from Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry, or a very important article, Nazism Rises Again in Germany, that is on our website right now, that talks about this. And this is where I think the mainstream media in the United States has done a massive, massive disservice. You know, they've spent the last, 8 years now, pointing at Donald Trump and saying Nazi. And that is damaging in itself, to point to someone who is very clearly not a Nazi, and calling, you know, that kind of incendiary false accusation is reprehensible and wrong just in its own right. But I think what it's also done is you do have genuine far-right parties, and like Europe, it's a spectrum. I don't like painting with a broad brush, because I think the AfD is very different from the National Front, which is very different from Hetfield. Like, there are commonalities in Europe, absolutely, in the rise of this fringe, but each local party is quite different. But the AfD is genuinely far-right and genuinely has neo-Nazi elements to it. And I think America is mostly blind to it because everyone sees the mainstream media. They point to the AfD and say they're far-right, they're neo-Nazi. And of course everyone ignores them. I would too if I didn't have any. Like, they've spent 8 years making demonstrably false Nazi accusations. And so when they point to the AfD and say they're Nazis, well, yeah, a lot of people don't believe them.
Right.
And I don't blame them for that.
Right.
But you look at what this is saying. These are a genuinely, genuinely worrying party. You have Bjorn Höcke. He's one of their key leaders. He's called Germany's attempts to kind of commemorate and memorialize its World War II history a stupid coping policy. He's condemned Germany building a Holocaust memorial in Berlin, and he's complained that no other country would build, quote, a monument of shame in the hearts of its capital. He says the nation needs a 180-degree reversal of the politics of remembrance. He said the AfD is the last revolutionary, the last peaceful chance for our fatherland. Another key leader, Alexander Gauland, he said, if the French are rightly proud of their emperor and the Britons of Nelson and Churchill, we have the right to be proud of the achievements of German soldiers in two world wars. Two world wars, you know, both World War One, World War Two. You had Höcke, he used even recently the slogan Alles für Deutschland, which, okay, everything for Germany, maybe on its own, that doesn't sound too concerning. It's the slogan for Hitler's stormtroopers. You know, he knows that. He's using that deliberately. Last year, their current leader, or at least he was last year, Tino Chapruglia, he said historical guilt should no longer determine the way we act. you know, we need to change our military policy. We need to forget about World War II. We need to be an aggressive and assertive party. That's what's coming from the AFD. I get emails, regular email updates from this Compact magazine, which is, it's kind of like what Fox News used to be to the Republican Party. It's not an official AFD organ, but it's written by AFD supporters for other AFD supporters. And it is shocking. Like, they had a special issue. The special issue was called Death Camps of America, accusing Eisenhower of carrying out mass executions of German prisoners in 1945. They had a special issue on Dresden that included sections about the mass murderer, as they called him, Winston Churchill. They had another special issue called Lost Homeland on the martyrdom and unspeakable suffering of Germans that were expelled from Eastern Europe after World War II. Another special issue was Crimes Against Germany. You know, it's a very different view of World War II in which Germany was unfairly victimized. The Nazis and the Allies, they're kind of as bad as each other, really. There's no real good guy, bad guy. And the Germans have been unfairly victimized by this Nazis a bad legacy. Like, that is fundamentally part of who this party is. When you see 17% of the vote, 20% of the vote voting for these people, you know, this is not people supporting a kind of German Donald Trump movement. It is much, much more extreme than that. And that's what Mr. Flurry drives home in this article, that this is very concerning. And this is exactly what Herbert W. Armstrong was talking about. I mean, one of the things he talked about, we mentioned this Deutschlands for Deutschland song last week, this song that's becoming popular. It's the number one most, the original song for that is now the number one most popular downloaded song in Germany. It's kind of taking the charts. This random song from like 2011, I think it was released by, is now number one in the charts because people are singing these AFD lyrics to it. And you look at the videos, like I saw one video of people singing to it that went viral. And what to me is surprising, the first time I saw this, it was kind of like skinheads at a disco. Okay, not too surprising to see a bunch of drunk people sing, like, that's concerning, mate, say, but not massively surprised. This, though, the video, this was very well-dressed. They kind of looked like bankers, wealthy businessmen at a rich, fancy restaurant. They're all wearing ties. They're quaffing champagne. They're singing Deutschland für Deutsches, Ausländer raus. And one of them there, he's got two fingers up as a mustache and he's dancing with a Hitler salute. This has gone beyond the typical minority, say, of extreme thugs, and is becoming mainstream. And that's exactly what we've been warning about in Germany. Now, you know, I mentioned, okay, this guy was the AfD's leaders last year. I'm not sure where he is now. This is the AfD's problem, is they don't have a strong leader, and this is kind of why they keep churning through different leaders. But the support for the AfD, it shows just a massive dissatisfaction with the way that Germany is going, to the point that people are willing to embrace this extreme and extremely different view about foreign policy. They believe that America is basically the bad guys in the world and that Germany should ally with Russia and that NATO is a conspiracy to clip Germany's wings, basically. So they're wanting a massive change there. They're wanting a massive change in the way Germany deals with other countries, with migrants. And again, there are real problems with migrants. I don't blame people for being concerned about that. But it's a massive shift for Germany. And that is exactly what Herbert W. Armstrong forecast, where he talked about the rise of a strong leader. So what Mr. Flurry's been saying since, you know, one of our earliest issues back in 1991 was all about the rise of a strong German leader. This is a key Bible prophecy. We've been warning about this for years. This Nazi spirit is going to arise again in Germany. And it's there. You know, it's here. Like, it's really dramatic. It is a really dramatic fulfillment of what we've been saying for a long time. And people are blind to it because all of these false accusations of Donald Trump as a Nazi. But there's very dramatic Bible prophecy being fulfilled before your eyes in Germany. And it's something that America does need to wake up and be very concerned about, because these people hate America. Like, that is the direction they really want to take Germany in. They may act at times like they're allies of the kind of the MAGA movement. They are not. And this is going to take all of Europe in a direction that ultimately leads them against America.
This is not the mild politics of European, German, French politics of 2007 or the 90s or the 80s or the 70s or the 60s or the 50s. This is something that is volatile. This is something that does have echoes of the 40s and 30s in Germany. Nazism Rises Again in Germany was the name of that article. Nazism Rises Again in Germany. And remember, in the 30s, in the 40s, nationalist rhetoric made sense to a sophisticated first world people. And socialist rhetoric made sense to those people, sophisticated first world, in many ways, admirable people. And they listened to that rhetoric. They began to vote according to it. They demanded change. And that change was delivered by Adolf Hitler. So it's easy to look back and just think that the world could never go there again. Germany could never go there again. It's not going to be an exact carbon copy. You're not going to see people wearing those uniforms and flying the swastika. But you have to be looking for that spirit that is rising again in Germany in a modern form and with some pretty clear historical echoes. Now let's go to the next region that was really in the news. I was transfixed by some of this footage that came out of the Middle East this week. Mihailo Zekić, give us the rundown of the top stories before you get to the main story.
A lot to get to over the weekend. As I'm sure many of our listeners know, there was a massive hostage release in Gaza from Israeli commandos. There were only 4 hostages released, but that's more than all the other surviving hostages that have been released from Gaza by the Israeli military to this point. Those 3 men and 1 woman, the young woman, Noa Argamani, she's famous for being in the video on October 7th of being dragged away from her boyfriend via motorcycle. So she's back home now. There's still plenty of hostages left. Hamas, for their part, have told CNN, or at least a spokesman, that they're not even sure how many hostages are left alive, which is pretty worrying. These 4 hostages, they were actually recovered from civilian locations inside average Gazans' apartments. One of the guys that said that he could hear kids playing around and the family having dinner while he was locked up, tied up in the attic. This is not, you know, your raging jihadi with the green headband in some dark tunnel or whatever. These are the average people. And a recent poll came out showing that the average person in the Palestinian territories, not just Gaza, still supports Hamas quite a bit. So when people try to separate Hamas from the general Gazan population or the general Palestinian population, they're one and the same, official party cards or not. But moving on from that, there's been a lot more news with Israel. Benny Gantz, we mentioned him last week. He finally left the war cabinet as per his ultimatum. And now he's arguing that Prime Minister Netanyahu needs to take a ceasefire. So we've written on the website before about some influence the American government has with him and perhaps grooming him as a potential successor to Netanyahu. It looks like Mr. Gantz is playing along with that. Speaking of ceasefires this week, the United Nations Security Council also greenlit Biden's ceasefire proposal that we talked about last week. 14 out of 15 voting yes, only Russia abstaining because it didn't want to look like they were siding with an American proposal. This ceasefire, as we talked about, leaves Hamas legitimized in Gaza. And if the whole world is agreeing that's what we need to do, that is very, very bad news for Israel, to say the least.
Yeah, dramatic news out of Israel, especially this week from the individual level, 4 hostages being freed, to the national level with Gantz, and then the international level. A lot happening on Israel. We've got to keep our eye on Israel. You want to keep our eye this week on the main story, also has to do with Israel. Go ahead and give us that main story.
It's on the other side of Israel, on its northern border with Lebanon. There have been escalating cross-border attacks between the Israeli Defense Forces and Hezbollah, the Iranian proxy that controls Lebanon as its own fiefdom, basically. And it's widely regarded as Iran's most powerful, most well-funded, most well-armed terror group. They've obviously been doing skirmishes since October, since the war started. They've been hesitant to actually create an open war, an open conflict. Looks like this might be changing, and we're seeing some tremors of that this week. On June 10th, Hezbollah tried to down several IDF jets. This is the first time they've actually aimed at airplanes. Israel retaliated and neutralized the terror cell near the ancient city of Tyre that tried to do that. On June 11th, Israel assassinated Talib Sami Abdullah, who was a senior Hezbollah commander who had Israeli blood on his hands from years back. On June 11th and 12th, Hezbollah, in retaliation, launched at least 170 rockets into Israel, one of the largest, if not the largest, barrages Hezbollah had sent over. And just today, I read that the IDF announced Hezbollah had sent 16 explosive-laden drones within the past 72 hours across the border. The IDF intercepted 11 of them. This is very fast-paced escalation going between these two sides, two very well-armed sides. Again, Hezbollah has been nipping at the heels for quite a bit at Israel. Why is this particularly big news? Axios has been having exclusive reports from anonymous sources in the U.S. government that the U.S. is actually trying to discourage or dissuade or pressure Prime Minister Netanyahu not to invade Lebanon. This is a paraphrase from one of the officials from an article on June 12th. Quote, the U.S. is concerned about Israel rushing into a war with Hezbollah or getting dragged into one without a clear strategy or consideration of the full implications of a wider conflict, end quote. Previously, they also reported that the U.S. is trying to dissuade Israel from, the government officials' words, a limited war. If the United States government is trying this hard to invest so much energy, invest so much time into telling Netanyahu not to do this, you know that Netanyahu really, really, really wants to do this and probably would have done this long time ago if it weren't for this kind of pressure. There are thousands of Israelis that are evacuated from the northern areas because Hezbollah is constantly launching these missiles, constantly launching these rockets, constantly making it unsafe for them to live there. And Netanyahu and plenty of other people, including Gantz, including Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, said that if Hezbollah doesn't stop this, we are going in. And if you're seeing the U.S. scramble, like what they did with the Rafah crossing, which, as many of our listeners I'm sure know, Netanyahu ignored them and did that anyway, you could be sure the risk of an Israeli invasion, or at least a limited war, whatever that means, into Lebanon, direct conflict with Hezbollah, bringing a new theater, a second front to this war with an even more armed group, is very, very high.
Things are escalating in the Middle East. With Israel, we keep our eye on Israel. We keep our eye on Jerusalem. And to see them now facing and, for lack of a better option, wanting to strike back against Hezbollah in a big way, while still at war with Hamas, while enduring pressure from the Biden regime of the United States, the pressure is increasing, the violence is increasing, and we've got to keep our eye right there on Jerusalem. There's a specific reason for that, isn't there?
There's one particular prophecy that ties in with this that we're looking for. Psalm 83 is a prophecy of an alliance of different Middle Eastern peoples aligning themselves with Asher or modern Germany, and we've written extensively about how this is a prophecy for today. This was never fulfilled anciently. There's no historical record of it. And specifically, verse 7 of Psalm 83 mentions Gebel, or in ancient Greek records, Byblos, and Tyre, two Phoenician city-states in the modern territory of Lebanon, and that they're going to be allied with Assyria. They're going to be allied with Germany. They're not allied with Germany right now. They're about as far away from the German camp in the Middle East as could be. They're basically Iran's lapdog, which, as we know, Iran, from other prophecies that we talk on this program quite often about, like Daniel 11, Iran and their allies are going to be against Germany. That's how we know there's going to be a split somehow. How exactly that's going to happen, we don't know, but it's a logical assumption that somehow Hezbollah is going to get out of the equation, especially with Lebanon's huge Catholic population that already hates Hezbollah, that already looks to Europe for guidance and leadership, hopefully for them at least. So with what we're talking about right now with Israel and Hezbollah, where does Germany fit into this? Well, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. Our editor-in-chief, though, has strongly suspected that the reason Hezbollah hasn't gotten involved into the conflict yet is because of Germany. Germany said some very strong statements, some very strong warnings, and that coincides with when Hezbollah backed off a little bit. If a war breaks up between Israel and Lebanon, a full-scale war, there's just so many different angles, potential angles to happen. We can't speculate too much, but this is a general lens that we're expecting everything to fall through, and this is what we'll keep watching for.
You mentioned in your outline the article, An Alliance Between Arab Nations and Europe, at thetrumpet.com. That's An Alliance Between Arab Nations and Europe. And just as you were talking there, I was thinking of Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's article. Right in the aftermath of October 7th, right as the Gaza war was starting, such a good title. As you watch Gaza, watch Germany. And remember, he talks about Germany intervening in relation to Hezbollah. So looking for German involvement in the Middle East. You also have the link here in the outline that I'll put in the show notes, The King of the North, The Key of David by Mr. Fleury, television program, The King of the North. And we'll put that in the show notes. So look for those articles and that video there. Moving on to Asia. Jeremiah Jacques, give us the headlines from your region that you've been watching.
Sure. Yeah. First, a quick one about Russia making overtures to Mexico. This happened Sunday when Kremlin State TV listed Mexico as being one of Russia's military allies and said that they're hoping to place Russian missiles on Mexican territory soon so that Mexico can, you know, be ready to attack the United States. Doesn't look like there's really very much to back this up, so it seems mostly just to be more bluster from Russia, but it does give you some serious Zimmerman telegram vibes, which is what finally woke American isolationists up during World War I to the dangers of Germany. So pretty interesting development there, I think. And then while we're on the topic of Russia, I wanted to quickly mention Russia's war on Ukraine. Very little has changed on the front lines, just a few kilometers shifting here and there. But a new poll shows that the Ukrainians are hardening more and more against the idea of being assimilated into Russia. This poll was conducted by the Rating Group, surveying 2,000 Ukrainian adults from across the country. Shows that only 5% of Ukrainians think that Russia is winning the war. 73% think that Ukraine will eventually liberate all of its territories. And then 59% think that the war will be over within 2 years. Only 18% think Ukraine should give up on its ambitions to align with Europe. So this is interesting because this has become a war of attrition, and the numbers are on Russia's side. And the Russians have been hoping to tire Ukraine out and just wear the people down, but it does not seem to be happening. The Ukrainians overwhelmingly want to keep on fighting, and overall they are optimistic about the outcome. And then we had a possibly a related development just today from the other side of the war. Russian President Vladimir Putin called for an end to the fighting. He said he wants to end it, but only on the condition that all sanctions on Russia be lifted. There is evidence that some of those sanctions are finally starting to bite, so he wants those lifted. He also wants Ukraine to formally agree to be Russian-aligned and abandon all ambitions to align with Europe. And he wants Ukraine to give him the entirety of the Kherson region, Zaporizhia, Luhansk, Donetsk, and of course Crimea. Right now, Putin doesn't even have control over all of this land that he's saying he would require in order to end the war. So all of this does show that he is struggling at present, and the facts on the ground show that, and the economic indicators show that as well. But with his terms for peace as they are, I think it's extremely unlikely that Ukraine would go for this deal, especially given the optimism among Ukrainians right now that they really think they'll win.
Back to that Russian communique to Mexico that caught my eye, because as many people have been talking about this week, you had the four Russian naval vessels in Havana Bay, Cuba, Vladimir Putin sending a message. I know that one was a nuclear-powered submarine, and then three other naval vessels right there in Cuba, 90 miles away from the United States. Pairing that with a message to Mexico is clearly a message of a threat. I mean, it's a threat. We can strike you. So in its own way, kind of an escalation there, at least in rhetoric, at least in strategy and moving actual warships just 90 miles off the United States coast. So Russia, very aggressive, very active, not shrinking back, whether it's their war in Ukraine or its opposition toward the United States. What's the main story out of Asia?
Yeah, the big story is that China's unlawful and belligerent behavior in the South China Sea has become an existential issue for the Philippines. That's according to an assessment by Philippine Defense Secretary Gilbert Teodoro that was published on Tuesday. Mr. Teodoro summarized a lot of what China has been doing over the last few months in these waters that lawfully belong to the Philippines. The Chinese have been using military-grade lasers and also water cannons to prevent the Philippines from resupplying its garrison on the Second Thomas Shoal. The footage of some of these attacks shows that they are often very intense. They have injured Philippine soldiers. They've also damaged some Philippine ships. Earlier this month, China also used these tactics to prevent the Philippines from evacuating a soldier on that garrison who needed to be hospitalized for illness. So China is really just doing all it can to bully the Philippines and antagonize them. And what we have to keep in mind is that international law clearly shows that this is happening at a location that's well within the Philippines' exclusive economic zone. So this is not disputed territory. It's not contested territory. This is a part of the Philippines. And yet, China has decided that they want it. And they know that they're much stronger than the Philippines. So they say, international law be hanged. We don't care about that. The only thing that matters is that we want it and we have the strength to take it. And so they're trying to illegally take this maritime area. China actually claims almost all of the massive South China Sea as its own, including parts that legally belong not just to the Philippines, but also Vietnam, Brunei, Malaysia, and some others. It's no wonder that China wants this region. It's full of critical shipping lanes. Just a huge amount of global trade flows through here. And it's also very resource rich. Something like 10 billion barrels of oil are believed to be contained there, and trillions of cubic feet of natural gas. The fisheries are very significant as well. Mr. Teodoro talked about this in his statement. He said, "The resources in the South China Sea are necessary to sustain future generations of Filipinos. We need all of these resources within the boundaries that have been provided to us by international law. And we need to stand up for this. If not, these will be chipped away by China." End quote. So it's an intense situation there in the South China Sea, and it looks like it'll only get more intense in the weeks and months ahead.
As you're talking there, I was thinking of the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. If you've ever read about World War II history, that's what the Empire of Japan was trying to create. They were trying to conquer and subjugate East Asia, like everything in East Asia. And you just see that Empire of Japan flag on all these different islands. That's what the Japanese Navy was trying to accomplish. I'm picturing in my mind the Greater East Asian Chinese-dominated co-prosperity sphere, in quotes.
I think Xi Jinping is probably picturing that as well.
He probably has that map on his wall.
Yeah.
I mean, that's clearly, if they're willing to go, you know, to not sort of get the disputed islands first and then just gradually get, you know, make their way in, but to actually just go straight into someone's sovereign territory.
Yeah.
That's not a mistake. And it's a message. It's a threat of its own. And it's showing that one way or the other, they're going to get that territory. They're going to get control of the South China Sea. And that's not where it's going to stop.
The only thing that would stop them is the United States. You know, the Philippines is a partner to us, as are some of these other nations. And it looks like the U.S.'s will to stand up for its partners is increasingly in question. And China knows that. That's why the Chinese are testing these boundaries and being so provocative.
Right. That's becoming clear in the absence of the United States doing real containment of China. Where does it end?
Well, that's the big question, and that's what we see in the headlines every week. We see the U.S. backing down and not really defending partners around the world, not defending the will of nations to determine their own path into the future. But this is very interesting. Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry, he has said that China's efforts, specifically in the South China Sea, China's efforts there to take over that region, he has said that this should, quote, alarm the world because it means China is steering the world toward war, end quote. That was in the Trumpet's July 2016 print edition that he wrote an article by that title. It's called China is Steering the World Toward War. And in one part of it, he writes, China's takeover is positioning Beijing to challenge seven decades of American naval dominance in the Pacific Rim. China is intimidating the nations of Southeast Asia into submission to its will. Everything is headed in the direction of war, end quote. And then Mr. Flurry also emphasizes in this article that China's takeover of this region is contributing to the fulfillment of a Bible prophecy about modern America and Britain being besieged by China and other nations. Deuteronomy 28:52 talks about this future besiegement of the U.S. and Britain, and about them having sea gates that they once controlled taken over by enemy nations such as China. And Mr. Flory says that China's belligerence in the South China Sea is one of many areas where onlookers today can already see this prophecy moving toward its fulfillment.
That's China is steering the world toward war. In East Asia, China has carrots. It has the world's largest economy. It can bail you out of debt. It can bring investments in. It can build highways and railways and ports almost overnight, it seems. But it also has the sticks, and it's not afraid to use those. And you can imagine if they really go rampant and begin to seize the islands and the different passageways that they want, they can redraw the map, like we were saying. Like, they are redrawing the map, and you can read about that. And China is steering the world toward war. Now let's move to the Anglo-America region. Andrew Miller, give us the top stories that you think are the most important from the Anglo-America region.
Hunter Biden was found guilty of all three felony gun charges brought against him this week, making him the first child of a sitting U.S. president to be convicted of a crime. And by my count, means that he has now been formally convicted of 0.65% of the 459 violations of state and federal laws chronicled against him on his laptop. Meanwhile, eight people from Tajikistan with ties to the Islamic State were arrested in New York this week after they illegally entered the United States through the southern border last spring and were released by the Biden administration after passing through a screening process. And shockingly, a California state senator, so a fairly important person in U.S. politics, was talking this week about how sexually confused children actually belong to the LGBTQ community and not their foster parents, which means that basically any sexual deviant in California has just as much say as to what happens to those children as the people who have formally adopted them. All of these are pretty big developments in Anglo-American region this week, but the main story I wanted to focus on is something you probably haven't heard as much about, which is the fact that a Chinese megaport in South America is sparking a resource war with the United States. Ports are not something that normally makes front page news.
But they totally should.
Wall Street Journal, but they totally should, because this megaport, China started building it last year, and it will be, it's about 70% done as of this week. And the leader of Peru is going to be going to the leader of China to meet a little later this month, and they're planning a big inauguration ceremony in November. It's in Chonce, Peru, and it's costing China $3.5 billion. But the reason it's significant is it's actually the first deep water megaport south of California on the eastern side of the Pacific Ocean. Right now, there's a couple big megaports on the eastern side of South America, but along the west coast of Mexico, South America, there's currently no megaports.
Zero.
And when I mean megaport, is those big mega ships you've probably seen loaded down with container ships going across the ocean. Those things are so big and they're so heavy that if they sail into waters shallower than 40 feet, they hit the bottom. Because there's actually, you see the ship, but there's like 40 foot of ship under the water. Mm-hmm. So a megaport's got to be bare minimum 50 foot deep. So this one they're building in Peru is 60 foot deep. So deep enough that they can actually have a ship sail all the way from the South China Sea, which Jeremiah was talking about just a minute ago, across the ocean into Peru. So right now, if you're a lithium miner in Chile or a blueberry farmer in Peru or anything like that, it's like you either have to ship your goods to China in small batches in a little ship, or more likely, you put it on a smaller mid-sized ship and you go up to California. And then in the megaship across California.
Yeah,
across to China.
Across the Pacific, yeah.
This port would allow them to cut directly, which has a number of people down there pretty excited. I actually do have a quote from a blueberry farmer in Chile who says this is going to be a window into Asia. And then he explained to the Wall Street Journal that it actually currently takes 35 days for him to
if you wanted to, ship blueberries from Peru up the coast to California, load it on a megaship, go across, and by that point, the blueberries are no good.
Right, and deal with United States regulations as well, a third party.
But if you go direct, you can cut that in third, which means now not only does China get a window into all the lithium mines of Chile and all the mineral wealth of South America, they're actually able to buy South American food, which is something they haven't been able to do up to now. Lithium doesn't spoil, so they can take their time if they need it. But food has not been something that's been able to go to China, or at least perishable foods like fruits and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So this is a big economic deal besides. But like I said, so the resource war, too, is it actually gives China the ability to cut America out of the equation. I mean, Jeremiah already talked a bit about those prophecies about sea gates and being besieged in their gates. This idea that this longstanding prophecy that Europe and China are going to team up to actually like freeze the United States out of world trade. Up till now, like I said, you're talking about like China's going to do a trade embargo against the United States, and your reaction, if you know a little bit more about logistics, could be, well, how? It's like they need all this mineral wealth from Latin America. And currently, right now, it's like you've got like California's a way stop. It's like you have to ship to the United States and then to China, mm-hmm. unless you're just taking it across in little batches or go down across the Terra de Fuego, which is really dangerous, and then across the really long way. So a port like this does give China, like that blueberry farmer said, a window into South America where they can come directly across, look at that wealth from South America, while actually just cutting America out of that trade route completely, which doesn't mean that you're going to feel, it doesn't mean like you're going to feel the effects in your grocery bill this December after a month after the port's inaugurated, because China is still trading with the United States, but it gives them the logistic ability to fulfill that prophecy at some point after this November when they want to.
And we've made this point before. You asked me, actually, should I talk about Hunter Biden's gun conviction or, you know, this other thing or the ports? And I said, do the port, because if you'd like to listen to more about, you know, the ramifications of Hunter Biden's conviction and the lawfare going on against Donald Trump, and listen to the Trumpet Daily. You can see it there at thetrumpet.com and subscribe to the Trumpet Brief. But I said, go for the ports, because as we've said so often, and maybe by repeating it, it'll be emphasized in your mind that, as I've said before, look around the room you're in, and the things in the room got there on a ship. In fact, in most cases, the copper inside your electronics or the lumber inside your walls or whatever it is crossed the ocean multiple times in various stages of production before it became the final product that you now use. We don't have to think about that. We never have to look at ports and cranes and, you know, nobody ever goes down to the port facilities. But that it comes to you. All this stuff in the modern world crosses the ocean multiple times. I often think of the example, I think it's in Basic Economics by Thomas Sowell, where he says that people catch fish in Alaska, ship it to China, flash freeze it, ship it to China for packaging or whatever, and then ship it back across the Pacific Ocean a second time to sell it in the United States when they caught it in Alaska. That's actually the most efficient way to sell that particular product. So there's a massive circulation of goods, of materials before they even become finished goods, that is constantly going on that you never have to think about. But if Trumpet Hour can make you think about it a little bit every other week, that's very important, because it will change the world. Much of the United States dominance, especially from World War II on, is because of things traveling on boats. The manufacturing capacities, the economics of the world has very real world consequences. China's getting a bite of South America. Europe's watching that. Europe's saying, hey, if the United States is fine with, as Barack Obama literally said when he literally explicitly ended the Monroe Doctrine, we're fine with other powers coming in to the Western Hemisphere. You can see a resource war breaking out, and the United States very logically being the loser of that war.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's definitely a big highlight of, I think, a verse Jeremiah already mentioned in Deuteronomy 28, verse 52, about America being besieged in all its gates. We can also recommend the literature China's Dangerous Move Against America by Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury, which talks about that prophecy in Deuteronomy 28 about being besieged in your gates. It also goes through another prophecy in Genesis where God promised Abraham the gate of its enemy, like singular, and then talking about the, like, well, the United States being the superpower of Israel and the Panama Canal being the most important gate to the United States. That prophecy, and all the way back in Genesis, is, it's not talking about gates. There's other verses that talk about gates, but there's like one gate being the Panama Canal, and this port's in Peru, not Panama. But it also does give China a strong foothold just south of Panama, where if you're looking at projecting military power, that's a common comeback. People be like, oh, well, the Chinese own the company that collects the tolls at Panama. They're like, yeah, but the U.S. Navy's still in the Caribbean. So it's like, we could take it back if we needed it. But you start getting other bases down here in Peru and stuff like that, where you can put in a military ship there just as easy as you can put a megaship. It starts giving you the ability to protect that gate, which is going to be any future trade war. Like I said, yeah, military fights over the gate of your enemy, in this case, Panama, are going to be almost inexplainably important.
That's right. And it's amazing how specifically Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury applies verses in the Bible, last written 2,000 years ago, to specific countries and specific gates, specific ports, specifics, just beyond you, what you would expect. And I'm sure that most people here, when there's so much of the Bible that is forecasts of the future, prophecies, and you don't hear that on Sunday, you know, Sunday services. Well, why is it in there? What does it mean? And as I said, Mr. Fleury has specific applications. And so you have to read these. Read in the Bible, it says you'll be besieged in all your gates, and think about what that might mean, and read China's Dangerous Move Against America and these other that we've mentioned, and prove for yourself if that is not a fulfillment. When you said besieged in all thy gates, there are no bigger gates in America or in the world than their ports. Those are the biggest gates, bigger than airports, bigger than spaceports will ever be, bigger than rail terminals or highways. The ports are the biggest gates, and this talks about a besiegement in all thy gates. Again, that's China's Dangerous Move Against America. So thanks for that update from Anglo-America, Andrew. That is our Trumpet Hour for June 14th. We appreciate all of our panelists, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, and Mihailo Zekic. And again, email us your thoughts on the program at letters@thetrumpet.com. We'd like to hear your thoughts. Do you ever think about ports? What do you think about ports? letters@thetrumpet.com. Let's treat on that subject. Thanks to Parker Campbell and Isaac Lorenz here in the room with us for their engineering and production. We appreciate all of you guys' work. Thank you for listening to The Week in Review. We look forward to being back with you next week on Trumpet Hour.